listening to Talking Architecture and Design, brought to you in association with the Architecture and Design Network. You can catch up with news, projects, interviews, and much more at architectureanddesign.com.au, where you can also subscribe to our newsletters and magazine. Once again, we have with us in our not-so-virtual studio, Tone Wheeler, the owner and founder of Environa, architect, educator, all-around raconteur, dare I say. And today's subject will be why our cities breed inequality. The discussion will revolve around extremely low-density city of suburbia, of which we all know well in Australia, with single houses, is no longer fit for purpose. Not in the three measures of sustainability. They are not socially desirable, not environmentally safe, and they are certainly financially ruinous, making us a most unequal society. The discussion of housing, schools and education, workplace and recreation, all eventually lead to inequality. So, welcome to Talking Architecture and Design, Tone Wheeler. And so tell me, these three themes of cities, housing and inequality, it's a theme really, isn't it, that we are seeing that's playing out in the mainstream media. It's not just publications such as Architecture and Design. It's now becoming a talking point, isn't it, amongst the masses.
Yeah, I think it's an incredibly topical thing, this topic.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost the flip side of the last time that you and I spoke, when we were talking about how the architectural profession is broken. In a sense that you could actually say, you know, why are our cities broken? And I think that's the milieu in which architects work. And I think that let's differentiate between architects working at architecture in Australian cities. Mm-hmm. I think architects still have work. Architects are still doing really interesting work.
They are.
And I think one of the upsides of that is that our cities have become more and more distinct from each other. You can tell a Brisbane or Southeast Queensland building from a Sydney building, from a Melbourne building, from a Perth building. There are different regional differences. And I think that's becoming more and more attuned to the climate. As climate change issues become more important, it becomes more reflective of the urban areas in which they're building. You know, the CBD areas take on different flavours. They have different qualities to them. That's not what I want to talk about.
No, that is actually true, and it wasn't. It wasn't the case maybe 30, 40 years ago. It's now become the difference between Brisbane, Perth, Sydney, Melbourne has become more marked. And I've noticed this. And if I notice it, then it must be happening. because it has grown. I mean, is there something going on there? Some sort of, you know, are they all developing their own personality, or is it that architects are working in sort of, dare I say, local silos?
Well, I'm more than happy to go down that little cul-de-sac for a moment. I think it starts with just two architectural firms 30, 40 years ago. And I think it's principally the work in Melbourne of Edmund and Corrigan, Maggie Edmund and Peter Corrigan,
right,
and their influence in teaching and all the firms that arose from that. The curiosity is that Edmund and Corrigan were in a gridded city. They were in a very ordered, structured city, whereas the Sydney was quite chaotic.
Yeah.
You know, because they were goat paths and stuff that ran all over the place. But I think the interesting thing is that in that gridded city, Edmund and Corrigan started to create an architecture that leapt out of the grid. It was very much the disconnected structures and very painterly, what I'd call a painterly collage. So it was pieced together from various pieces that were not necessarily germane to the building. They were theatrical. And it was often about the theatre of the street and the theatre of the inside of the building. And then that influenced a whole raft of firms in Melbourne directly. And then it created a milieu in which other architects flourished. I'm thinking about Ashton Raggett and McDougall and Charles McBride Ryan. And then bigger firms like Lyons, and then there's Greg Burgess. Even the more rigorous sort of architect like Peter Elliott still had that touches of that a collage making to it, mm-hmm. right, at one end. In Sydney, it's John Andrews.
Right.
And there are, I think there are a number of other architects that you could say it is, you know, whether it's Harry Slide at the beginning or Ken Woolley or Alan Jack and Cotier. But I'm saying John Andrews because I think his rationalist thinking that there was a directive way of making it, and then the building is what I would call a rational tectonic. The building shape is made by what it has to be. Not form follows function, but form follows forces. The forces of what's happening inside, what's happening outside, and what you're going to make it out of. And it's very rational work. There are then followers of John Andrews, not necessarily, but you've got a whole lot of people working in Sydney who are much more rational, Michael Dysart or Bruce Eales, and the firms that follow on from that, Peter Muller and so on, or their predecessors like Peter Muller, and Lawrence Neal's work, which is even more rigour added to flair. So that those two things. So it's this weird thing that in Melbourne you've got buildings that are very colourful and very disconnected in the sense and very much postmodern in that sense. And in Sydney you've got buildings which are rigorous frames infilled with variety of tectonically acceptable materials.
Right.
Right. If you want a perfect example of this, it's in Swanston Street, at the top end of Swanston Street at RMIT.
Okay.
There's a small remnant of John Andrews in this rigorous angular building that was for RMIT. I think it was going to be their new union building or something like mm-hmm. that. And it's a series of angles, regular triangle pieces filled with glass blockwork, the go-to mechanism for filtered light.
Right.
And then they stopped the building, which was very much a series of extruded elements that came up from that. They stopped it and they gave it to Peter Corrigan. And it became Building 8, which is the building that contained for so long the architecture school.
All right, okay.
And it's extraordinarily colourful and it looks like a fantasy city sitting on the top of it. So there is a very big difference between those two cities. And then I think things happened in Brisbane where John Mainwaring and Gabriel Poole developed up a more tropical style, Russell Hall, then it went to the Clares, Lindsay and Kerry Clare and so on. But that's not the subject of today's talk.
It's not. It's interesting you say that because the subject of today's talk is about how cities and housing, and that's a particular word that you've used, housing, breed inequality. And what you've started off is explaining differences in design, almost a cry for identity in difference.
Yes, it is. Yeah, identity is a good word for it, yeah.
But in the end, there is a functionality of a city, okay, and that is to house masses of people because we're no longer hunter-gatherers, or not most of us aren't anyway. So the point being is that almost when I read your intro, housing breeds inequality. Is that how I'm reading this?
Yeah, I think the conversation about the differences between Australian cities dates back to things like Hugh Stretton's book Ideas for Australian Cities, which has got to be 50 or more years old now, where he's talking about how cities might develop. What I'm talking about is a common theme across almost all, say, the big 10 cities in Australia, which are the cities, because after that you're really talking about regional towns. So we've got a limited number of quite big cities, you know, a couple that are verging towards 6 million, quite a few that are, you know, over 2 million.
Yeah.
By world standards, they're quite big cities in Western,
right,
in the OECD. And I think that they're big in the sense that they've got a number of people in, but they're huge in terms of the area and the spread. The density, for instance, that the Infrastructure Victoria identified in a recent report was that Melbourne's overall density is half that of Los Angeles.
Wow.
And everybody thinks of Los Angeles as being this suburban spread out, you know, sprawl, needing to be connected by freeways. But if you're half that, then you're really at a dysfunctional area. So I think there are several linked things about cities that we've established a particular character for our cities. All the cities are all suburban. The most urban of our cities is the Gold Coast.
Really?
Because, well, it has the most high-rises you see in the smallest area.
Oh, okay.
Right? There are a couple of other areas in Australia that in cities there is has long been Potts Point in Sydney, which has now been overtaken by Green Square in Sydney. But that's when you take a very small part of the city and you look at how many high-rises. But if you take it overall, the Gold Coast is not, because it's a huge hinterland of more and more suburban housing. So we've got this typology of housing and we've managed to make it the basis for the whole of Australian life. You know, it has the backyard and the barbecue and it is an individual ownership and there's no community involved in it. You're not part of a strata title or a company title, so you don't need to talk to your neighbours. You own what you own, all the air rights, all the ground rights. It gets back to that whole idea of when Australia was settled, you wanted to have ownership of land. And I think that's part of the psyche.
Apparently, we all wanted to play backyard cricket. I mean, isn't that the reason why we have the cities designed the way we are?
Yeah, and yet the councils are now building very good local parks which have good cricket pitches and football pitches and so on in them. I think if the individual suburban house is part of the psyche, and it was absolutely the ne plus ultra of what we were going to build, because I think it has those characteristics of being freestanding, you can do what you want almost, although we're extremely conservative about what we do stylistically.
Okay.
You know, you whole periods in which all the houses all look the same.
Mm.
You know, and you can go you can travel through a cross section of the city and look at Victorian architecture and then look at the Queen Anne,
mm-hmm.
and then beyond that the interwar architecture and the post-war architecture, and they all look the same, but they're different from each other. But there is very little diversity of type until the 1990s, and that's when you start to see a very interesting thing that is happening at that point, which is about home ownership. The first 100 years, effectively, of nationhood, from the 1890s onwards, let's say, there is a desire to make money out of property, firstly by owning a row of terraces and renting them out. So that was the very earliest form of property development.
Right.
It wasn't made to be sold. And in fact, when they came to carve them up in Sydney and Melbourne, there was all sorts of problems with where the boundaries were exactly going to be, because they were built by one builder who would be the builder-developer, and that was the way of making money. And that developer, inevitably a man, would put their mother's name on the terrace, you know, Gladys Terrace or Tilda Terrace.
That's where the names come from.
And then the second one was named after the daughter, and the third one's probably named after the wife, and so on. There's a tradition of them having women's names based on the family of the developer.
Oh, okay.
So that's abruptly halted when councils start to be formed, and they don't want the slums. They don't want the terraces. And so they say we must have blocks of land that are big enough that you can't join the houses up together. And they decided that what that would be a block of land that would be 1,000 square metres.
Quarter acre.
Which is a quarter acre. Not all the subdivisions were done that way. But the next annulus in every city in Australia, bearing in mind that this is when Adelaide, Perth and Brisbane are really just starting out. They don't have the 19th century, the large 19th century parts of the city which Sydney and Melbourne have. So the first part of it is suburbia. So in Adelaide, for instance, there's the CBD, and the moment you step outside that, it's almost all freestanding homes. And there are other things that they put in place at that time for the housing. There was the first mortgages in the world that were individually tailored to a person as a middle-class owner. They occur roughly at the same time, but Australia beats the United Kingdom and the USA in the exploitation of the mortgage that makes the Bank of New South Wales, amongst many others, incredibly wealthy.
Right.
So they no longer lend to a developer builder to do a terrace, they lend to an individual owner. And they must have a piece of land that they can identify, hence the Torrens title that's developed in South Australia and goes nationwide. And that means that you can identify the block of land and you put a house on it and they will pay for the house. Now, that idea is expanded after the First World War into developers as builders building houses for people on their own individual block of land. And we don't have time to go into it now, but that's essentially Albert Victor Jennings. It's A.V. Yes. Jennings. You know, he's a returned First World War serviceman. He takes a job as a, no longer as a dental technician, which is what he was, as a auctioneer for his brother-in-law. He's running a real estate firm and then realises that they can make more money if they build houses and sell them rather than waiting for people to bring them houses to sell.
Right.
And then he works out a way in which you have individual houses on a grouped block of land. So his first one is Hillside Avenue in Melbourne, and then there's Beauview, Beaucrest, Beaumont. They're all Beau. But they actually established between the First and the Second World War the idea of owning your own home, and the loans are coming firstly through the banks, right. And the banks want certain conditions for it. So Jennings is the one who understands that they won't lend to him as a developer. They'll lend to the owner of the block of land, and the owner goes to the bank with a contract written to A.V. Jennings, and then the bank pays A.V. Jennings to build the house, which is what happens now. I mean, we think of that as being absolutely the norm for most of the housing in this country, which is built, as we would call it, project homes. They are a means of you have a block of land or they sell you a block of land and then you sign up with a builder and the bank then pays you to pay the builder or pays the builder directly. And in many cases, the banks cut out the middleman, the owner, and they just pay they supervise the building. So in between the wars, the Commonwealth Bank gets so concerned about the quality, they issue their own standards. So there's a little booklet, I'm talking about a copy of, which is fantastic because it shows how house construction should be made using the brand new technology of brick veneer.
Right.
And this was a teaching tool in the 1960s and 70s in architecture schools. You use the Commonwealth Bank construction standards to teach architecture students how to build houses with brick veneer. That's the other thing that happens. The technology changes from being full brick, we don't have enough bricks to keep up, to brick veneer. It's trialled before the Second World War. And then after the Second World War, it takes off as being the main means of construction, with Jennings leading the way, but a number of other builders following suit. Critically at that point, we still are only 50% home ownership. Much of it is rental still. And interestingly, after the First World War, in particular, some women found themselves widows because they lost their men in the war and they had no source of income and women couldn't work. And so they opened their homes for people to live in as a bed and breakfast. So they were, that's where that comes from, is the middle-aged women running a boarding house or board and food for workers. So the working class is now living in those situations with big houses which are now being subdivided into different rooms. And you can see that all through Sydney and Melbourne and even parts of Brisbane, that these grand old homes got subdivided up so that the owners of the homes who had no income after the war, both the First and the Second World War, but particularly the First World War, ends up for rentals. So after the Second World War, Robert Menzies, our Prime Minister, makes a key speech, one of the sort of great speeches that are made in the federal government. He talks about the forgotten people. Who are they? They are the middle class who are renting and he wants them to have their own home. The easiest way to own your own home is to have a piece of land that you can identify, give it an ID as under the Torrens title, and then you build your own house or you buy it with a house attached or you buy it with a house and you do alterations and additions. And between the Second World War and the height of home ownership, which is the beginning of the 1980s, so in that 35 to 40 year period, we grow from less than 50% home ownership to 75%.
Wow.
And that is a growth where the middle class is expanding, tradies are becoming much more mainstream, much more middle class because of their wage at least, and they have a mortgage to buy a home. There's a small amount of people who own their own home outright. But for that 40-year period, it is very common for the returned servicemen. They have an act that provides them with a discounted loan. Okay. As part of their service in the Second World War, is that there's a war service home loan at a discounted rate. And there are many families who benefit from it, my own family included. We managed to buy a Cal Bung, as it was known, a Californian bungalow, in an established suburb. It was a pretty run-down sort of house, but Dad got it for a very, very good price. A house that he paid £6,000 for.
Where was that house?
I'm not saying, but yeah, suffice it to say that it's no longer in the family and well not in the family, and recently sold for something like $5
million. Wow.
So, you know, that's a 60, over 60 years, that's a big growth rate. But my point is that it's mostly people on a mortgage.
Right.
What Robert Menzies and the Liberal Party does is they say everybody's going to be, it's a market-driven idea to make banks wealthy, and that, and there's a whole number of banks sprout up that challenge the big Commonwealth-owned bank who is setting the standards. It's not until Keating sells off the Commonwealth Bank that we lose control of what the banks do by having a federally controlled bank. So there are a number of private banks and they grow enormously wealthy from mortgages. So what happens by 1990 is that there are a number of people who've paid off their 30-year mortgage. And that increases to the year 2000 to the point where, at that point, the number of people on mortgages has declined because the number of people who own a house outright has increased. So in terms of your first home, by 2015, pretty much where we are now, home ownership is divided into three parts. You own your own home outright. You are buying your house through a bank or building society. Right? Or you're renting. They're equal thirds. The figures fluctuate, but they're all 32, 31, 30%. It's around that. Right? So it's easy to understand that it's divided into thirds. So where it used to be mostly renters and we were trying to get people to buy their own home, over the time of that 20th century, we enabled people, so many people, to buy their own home that they bought it outright. And what that means is that they then are able to invest in a second home, a holiday house, or an apartment, or another house. Now, at the same time, we have to look at the decline of social housing. So after the Second World War, there was a movement by state governments, remembering that it's mortgage arrangements, federal government.
Right.
And they still have control of the tax arrangements for housing. So the federal government is the taxing body. State governments, however, have responsibility for housing those people who can't afford rent on the open market. And because most of the society is turning towards trying to build their own home with a mortgage, rental housing is very difficult to find outside of rundown inner city urban areas. And, people got to remember that Paddington was a workers' paradise at one time, both in Brisbane and Sydney, that they were places where you could rent quite a rundown house because it was 60 or 80 or more years old, and it was still in the ownership of the original developer's family. So it was needed that we build lots of social housing. And that was certainly the case that we were looking to England, in particular to the UK, and building houses in much in the same manner as was being done in England and Scotland, with what they called council housing, because those councils were bigger, they looked after a bigger number of people. But we did it as state housing. And that was quite a large percentage of the housing that was built was done between 1950, say, and 1980. And it rose to the point where, at its peak, over 10% of the Australian housing stock was owned by a state government and was rented out to the poor. Not to mince words about it, I'm not going to call it a socioeconomic class or whatever. We're talking people who are poor. And as the number of houses expands, it's sometimes in very prime areas as the city grows. Now, the other thing to remember is that between 1950-ish and now, that 70-year period, every city in Australia has doubled its numbers. It's doubled in size in terms of the number of people housed, more or less. I'm talking in abstract figures here. But what happens is that that doubling of population means that more and more people are renting, more and more people have mortgages, and then there's that secure original families who invested early on after the First or Second World War who are homeowners. The state government starts to lose interest in providing the housing because they don't have the money. A succession of federal Liberal National Party governments had no interest in socialism and social progress. Their interest is in reducing tax. So after Menzies, we get this idea that it's market driven. We move to the right, like the American states, like US, and we reduce down government spending, we tax less, we get less taxes, a proportion of GDP, and we go from being like the OECD was in the middle of the 1960s, where we're taxing about 30% of GDP, and it's now less than 25%. So we go from being a reasonable average in the OECD, which, by the way, is currently about 35% tax to GDP, and we're now the second lowest in the world.
Who's lowest?
The United States.
Of course.
But the difference is the United States has philanthropy. That's how they make... They have the very, very mega wealthy, some of whom, long-term, Rockefellers and so on, have put their money back into social programs. food for the poor, housing for the poor, health care, and so on. But Australia doesn't have that. We just simply have less and less tax, so we've got less and less money to build social housing. So social housing, or housing commission, or whatever you want to call it from that, dwindles from 10% at its peak down to about 3%.
Wow.
So that's why the waiting lists for social housing have dramatically increased, and we're not addressing any of that. Now, that's added to that, local councils don't want the riffraff. So whilst it starts at federation and you get the post-federation councils being established in the rings of suburbs that surround our main cities, you know, whether it's Toorak and Kew and Hawthorne in Melbourne, or whether it's the Strathfield Concord axis around Sydney and so on, right. They want quarter-acre blocks, and they want, because that's a better form of resident. They're paying a mortgage, it's secure, they're going to look after the property because they're worried about property value. So they try and design their suburbs to have mostly people who are the best kind of people is what they want.
Not the great unwash, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, let's get rid of the hoi polloi and let them suffer in the city, and we'll have more and more suburbia. So there are very, very few councils that encourage a city centre to have any, which is a marked difference between Sydney and all the other cities in Australia, in that Sydney has now grown so big that the CBD and the public transport is so poor that you can't get to the CBD. So other centres like Parramatta and Chatswood, St Leonard's and Hurstville and Penrith and so on grow up. And then there are ones that are not even recognised as such, but, you know, DY in the Pittwater region becomes a major centre for apartments and work because the transport, there is no railway line that goes up through the northern beaches.
Well, there would have been if they had a listener, Mr. Bradfield, wouldn't they?
Well, it would. The only one that you can go to the beach on a train is Cronulla. But anyway, so back to our story over time. What happens is the idea for the wealthy to own a second home, they get a leg up with two pieces of federal legislation. Negative gearing, mm-hmm. which says that you can write off all your losses in a home, in a second home, mm-hmm. against your income. Now, this is completely different to most other Western societies, and certainly in Scandinavia and the United States. You can write off your losses against your income, against your mortgage, for your own home, not for a second home.
Right.
So they encourage people to own their own home by having discounts in tax, but we do the reverse. We say, oh, you already own a home. Here, let us encourage you to have a second and a third and a fifth and a tenth by negative gearing, and then we will discount the capital gains tax that you make from selling it, which, unlike shares, unlike any other investments. So what we then do from about, basically from John Howard onwards, we are actively encouraging people to build and buy a second and a third home, which becomes the replacement for the social housing, which is declining. So the one-third of renters, remember them? The one-third of renters are now renting for the first third who are owners. And that's part of the problem we face at the moment, is that when interest rates go up and the homeowners who own them have a mortgage on their second or third or fourth property, they want to raise the rental for people who are in that one-third of people who can't afford to own a home or to be buying a home. So negative gearing and the discounts on capital gains are so entrenched for that rich third that that part of the Liberal National Party has convinced the populace that the world is going to fall in if you don't have negative gearing and other tax measures.
Can I just sort of pull it up? The negative gearing was introduced by the Hawke government.
It was indeed.
The ALP government.
Yes, it was, but and it was intended to try and encourage house building for new houses, and it was extended. It was made to be almost like a mandatory policy by Howard, is what I'm saying.
Oh, right, okay.
Now, in a recent quarterly essay, Alan Kohler, whom everyone will know from the ABC, has done an unbelievably accurate description of what I'm talking about for the last 15, 20 years, as the tax policies of the federal government have entrenched the inequality that if you own a home, you can own three. If you're paying off your home, you're struggling at the behest of the RBA.
Yeah.
So whatever the RBA is doing to it to try and control the economy, they're actually only screwing down on one third of the population who are trying to have a mortgage. The homeowners love it because their investments are going up in value. The renters are suffering at the hands of the homeowners because they're renting from them. So the people who are really squealing are the middle class who are trying to buy a house in the middle ring of the Australian cities. So this has driven a huge amount of inequality. Disappointingly, Alan Kohler says you can't solve it because no federal government will have the will to remove negative gearing and discounts and to perhaps change the regime so that what you negatively gear is your own home or houses under construction but not existing houses. Now, you and I are talking in the beginning of 2024 when I think things are turning. I think Alan Kohler's essay was incredibly difficult reading. It's very, very negative about negative gearing. But I do think that the change in the tax regime that Albanese's brought in for the stage three tax cuts has opened up this argument about we need more tax reform. And that's certainly what the Teals and the Greens are pushing for. And tax reform means widespread tax reform. Let's look at all the taxes. The never ever GST that Howard said we would never ever have, and now we have. It's one of the lowest sales taxes or goods and services tax in the world. It's bigger in New Zealand and certainly much higher. It's state by state in the United States, but let's not go there.
Mm.
But you've also got taxes on mining resources, on excessive profits tax, and so on. There's a lot of things that you could look at. And you could change the tax regime to make it fairer for people who are renting and purchasing, not for people who already own. I think there's going to be a very interesting argument. And there's a great deal of possibility that you could see negative gearing and discounts on capital gains taken to the next election. They would certainly want to do it while the Liberal National Party have a leader who is so unpopular as Peter Dutton. They might seize the opportunity to do something which many in the Labor Party want to do. They're spooked. They thought that they lost the 2019 election because of negative gearing.
Well, franking credits, wasn't it?
Oh, franking credits and everything. They lost it because you need a retail politician.
Yep.
And Bill Shorten was not a retail politician. So there's that tax at the top level, and the states are screaming for more and more money to build social housing. And so the states, which are mostly dominated by Labor Party politics now, have housing ministers who want to address the housing problem, not by market-driven economics of saying, oh, look, let's lend more mortgages and so on and let people buy homes. They recognise that there are people who will never have sufficient income to be able to afford a home. They will never have sufficient money, even though they may be working to buy a house or get a mortgage. And they never have enough money to rent a home from the homeowners. So you need to introduce this fourth rail of social housing for renters. And they're screaming for that money. And the Labor Party, unfortunately, has decided that housing, although it's going to be talked about a lot, it's not going to get much money. It's certainly not going to anything like the amount of money that you might put towards AUKUS submarines.
I notice every time they have some round table with ex-premiers like they had yesterday, the same people who never ever looked at negative gear seem to be very happy to look at negative gear now that they're in retirement. But is this why we're now seeing in Australia the build-to-rent phenomenon and whatnot?
Yes, it is. Yeah, exactly. And I think, I mean, you're referring to Dominic Perrottet, yeah. You know, the man who accused the Sirius social housing of being a car park and wanted to sell it off, which they did successfully, unfortunately. All of a sudden, they all know that negative gearing is warping the Australian dream of a fair go. There's one third of Australians will never get a fair go. They will never get to own a house. One third of them are at the behest of the Reserve Bank, which, by the way, I think is the most pernicious organisation in Australia, in that its control of the Australian economy is based on sending mortgage holders to the wall,
yep,
and driving up unemployment. Mm-hmm. They're the two statistics that they're working on,
yep,
in order to control. Where's the economy inflated? Industry profits. The profit margin of large companies is where inflation has been caused most. But back to the cities and inequality. One of the things that we can do now is change the typology of housing to better suit the conditions that we've got. We've got a very unequal playing field. We don't have social housing. So what about if in the people who have a mortgage or don't own a second house or owners can invest and build a second home, a duplex on their block of land?
Right.
What if they could put a granny flat? That's a terminology I hate.
Yeah.
A garden apartment, let us call it what it might well be, a garden apartment for it. What about if you could convert your house into two houses? What if you could get along with your neighbours and take down two or three houses and build an apartment block? We're designing one at the moment, which is in an area that's only 40 years old as housing development. Mm. But the council's rezoned it because it's on a main road so that three suburban houses can become 32 apartments.
Wow, okay.
So it's a tenfold increase. You don't lose the trees, you don't lose the deep soil. The car parking, which was on the street, is now underground underneath the building. Yet this idea of medium density in the suburbs is the last piece of the puzzle to fall. Many of the projects that we're looking at, which used to be let's develop a set of terraces, townhouses, duplexes, apartments for sale. And there's a sugar rush when you get the sale. And that's because the tradition has always been one third, one third, one third. One third of the money is spent buying the land. One third of the money is spent building the building and its cost, and one third is profit. Yeah, believe it or not, that's what developers were looking at so closely. They wanted that is a huge amount of profit.
That is.
And that's what's made 8 of the 20 wealthiest people in Australia. They made their money from property development. Mm-hmm. And every Australian who's a homeowner looks at that and goes, oh, that's a path. I don't know much about shares. I don't know much about investing. We don't have manufacturing to invest in anymore. Hey, let me take this block of land and turn it into a duplex or a block of flats and so on. That is the tension that lies between the homeowners who want to make money out of that, not necessarily on their own home, maybe in someone else's suburb,
right,
and the local councils who are saying, you know, NIMBY, NIMBY and notes.
Yeah.
You know, not in my backyard and not over there either. And I think that's a problem for the state government that wants to see more housing generally and more housing that is either less expensive to buy or cheaper to rent. And that means smaller houses, apartments, duplexes, terraces, there's a whole series. But it goes against the grain of Australian tradition that was built up over 100 years of home ownership on the individual block of land. An interesting story in this is that we weren't prepared after the Second World War for apartments. We didn't have legislation and tax arrangements for apartments. We would allow apartments to be built in certain areas, provided they were sold as a company, and it was what was known as company title. So from 1945 until, or even earlier than that, but after the Second World War, until 1961, in Australia, you, if you wanted to buy an apartment, you bought shares in a company and the shares were proportional to the amount of housing you got in the overall scheme.
Convoluted.
Very convoluted. Banks didn't like it because there was no individual homeowner to it and the rates were higher for company title and you needed much more of a deposit to buy a company title. So in a way, it was bizarre because apartments, the earliest apartments, those built in the 1930s, for instance, were in the wealthiest suburbs.
Yep.
And they were owned by the very wealthy. Just recently, a book's come out in Sydney, which documents the interwar apartment buildings. And you might think, oh, that's nice, it'd be a story of about five apartments. No, there's over 100 of these built between the two wars. So that's, you know, it's only a 30-year span, and they're building hundreds of, by very, very well-known architects. You know, was it Aaron Bollow or Emil Soderstrom and so on. And they were very, very good buildings. None of which, by the way, not one of those would pass the current apartment design guide.
Okay.
Right? They don't have balconies to them, and they don't have sufficient car parking, and they don't have lifts in them and whatever, but they're treasured in one of the wealthiest parts. So my part of my story is the banks are controlling everything. They control the mortgages. They go to people who own their own home and say, well, you've paid it off. How about we give you another mortgage and you go and buy a holiday house or you buy a block of apartments in another suburb or something like that. Banks control everything to the point where a very ambitious developer wants to build a much bigger apartment building and says to the bank, you know, we want to borrow the money to build this 170 apartments. And the bank says, well, we're not going to lend money to any of the purchasers. They'll have to purchase it outright because we're not going to do company title with 170 owners. So the developer says to the biggest legal firm in Sydney, he says, travel the world and tell me what the best way of home ownership is in a horizontal subdivision rather than vertical. In other words, not block by block by block, but by strata. And they come back with exactly that. There's a Strata Title Act. It's written by this firm of lawyers and it's given to Joe Carl, who's the Premier of New South Wales, who then immediately introduces it, as I understand it from reading about it, almost hollis bollis. It's exactly the same as it was written by the lawyers. The Strata Title Act is invoked in Parliament. It passes through, becomes law, and they're able to sell the 172 apartments in Blues Point Tower.
Right,
okay. So this is yet another reason for people to hate or love or loathe Blues Point Tower. And it changes the landscape for apartments. So from the 1960s onwards, we get the yellow and orange brick, concrete floored, eight-storey apartment buildings built all through the suburbs of Sydney and Melbourne. And it enables the really good buildings like Domain Apartments by Robin Boyd and the really terrible buildings that are the series of towers that run all the way along quite well-heeled streets. You know, you only have to look at Military Road in and parts of Cremorne and Mossman to know that the ridges were all being developed by these towers. Interestingly, that's the mode that the state government in New South Wales and Victoria wants to promote. It's called transport-oriented design. So you put the towers, which quite frankly aren't really towers. They're talking about 6 to 8 stories.
Right.
For most of it. It is not high-rise towers because they're difficult to do unless they're in clusters. So you look at Green Square or you look at Olympic Park or you look at the new developments on the edge of the CBD in Melbourne. They're clusters of towers because that's the New York, Chicago, Philadelphia way of understanding building high-rise apartment buildings. You cluster them together.
Right.
The lone tower like Harry Seidler's tower that was built on the ABC site in Darlinghurst, you can see exactly why that doesn't work because it's 2- and 3-story buildings around it. So we're talking about modest scale. The reason why 4 stories or 8 stories becomes the desired heights has to do with the technicalities of the building code. 8 stories was the maximum you could go without putting sprinklers in it until about 3 years ago. So you only needed 1 set of stairs, fire isolated, no stair pressurisation, in other words, no mechanical system to keep the smoke out of the fire stairs. That was why all the buildings are 8 stories. It's in fact done on height now. It's 25 metres to the top story, which is 8. What's happened is that they introduced sprinklers that must be now in buildings of 4 stories or more. So they've actually increased the safety level, which will have this knock-on effect that 3-story buildings become very desirable.
Right.
Because you don't have the extra costs of a machine pump room and a, you know, hydrant facility and everything else that you need if you've got sprinklers.
And the constant checking and the certification.
Oh, the yearly costs for that and 3-story walk-ups, you don't have to get the lift company back to fix the lift and so on. So there's lots and lots of reasons why medium density in the middle ring is what we're talking about. And we're talking about it in 3 ways. Firstly, the scale of the building needs to be compatible with what Australians feel is the suburban milieu, which has turned from single-story bungalows into 2-story McMansions, by the way.
Right.
But if you're in a transport-oriented design and you're along a tram line or a train line or a major road with a well-serviced by buses, then that's the area in which you can put what's called shop-top housing. So above the shops are 3 or 4 stories of apartments. Or along those roads you can have 4 or 5-story buildings which, hidden by trees and so on, mediate between that string of higher density and the lower density suburb. So it's the scaling down. Nobody is talking about wholesale destruction of suburbia.
Right.
Because you can't financially do it.
Do it right, okay.
Yeah, that's the thing people don't understand. They're not coming for your $5 million house on 1,000 square metres of land with the high blue gum forest or whatever else. Or they're not coming for your $2.5 million house on a block of land half that size and so on with a native garden or an Australian or a some low-scale non-Indigenous garden. It's really to do with taking those things which are inappropriate to today's developments, when the roads got wider, they got bigger, and the houses border those. They're too noisy, they're in an area where the value of the house has actually gone down because of the development around it, but it makes much better sense to coagulate those houses together and make a bigger site in which you can put 3 or 5 stories. On other parts of it, you can make a duplex on a block of land no bigger than a McMansion.
And how will this affect equality?
What it does is it means that there's going to be a lot of housing that's a lot smaller, mm-hmm. so it will be a little bit cheaper to buy. It will mean that there is a greater diversity. So singles or couples or share houses or whatever can buy, because up until now it's been a very large family home has been the main product that's, you know, housing as product on the market. And it will mean that the build to rent can actually, they can offer a much wider range of product. So, for instance, in New South Wales, there is a housing code which allows you to build things which they call a boarding house or a co-living.
Right.
And it has a different set of standards, a completely different set of standards to an apartment building. Now, no developer in an apartment building is building an apartment less than 50.1 square metres, because no bank will lend you money to a purchaser for anything less than 50 square metres. Boarding houses and co-living, you can't make any one of those bigger than 35 square metres and you can't sell them.
Right.
You can only rent them out. So if you look at Sydney's greatest post-war apartment buildings, the ones that were designed by Harry Seidler, many others, in the inner city areas of Sydney, if you look at the ones that were designed by Fred Romberg in Melbourne, you'll find that many of the apartments don't meet today's standards. They're between 35 and 50 square metres. And we don't have a code that covers that. And we don't have the ability of banks, who are the drivers of inequality in Australia, through federal government tax arrangements, saying, well, no, we won't lend to a very small apartment. I'm one person. And I need a pied-à-terre because I travel for 50% of the year. Or, you know, I need an apartment here because I work very close to where that is. No, you can't. You can rent something.
Right.
And increasingly, the small rental apartments will grow. There's an enormous growth factor in that.
Right.
Or else you're back into the apartment. So what we're going to see is massive changes in both, in the two big markets in Victoria and New South Wales. Well, in Newcastle, Sydney and Wollongong, and in Melbourne and Geelong, you're going to see a complete rethinking of what do we mean by medium density housing and what do we mean by build to rent. Architects are already working on that. That's the end of my story, is that I think architects are now offering a huge range of typologies that will enable them to be smaller, therefore more affordable, affordability in the sense of purchasing, or they will be affordable in rental terms. Because there are two different terms that we've developed now. One is housing affordability, mm-hmm. which is the ability to be able to buy a house. Can you afford to buy a house? That's the middle third on mortgages.
Right.
And then there's affordable housing, which is, can you afford to rent it?
Right.
It's a kind of weird distinction that we have. Architects are actually working on both of those things. Unfortunately, what the Institute of Architects awards and other things do is looking at the mega houses of the owners who are tearing down their reasonable family home and building some enormous monument to bad taste. And that's what's being featured. And many of the younger architects cut their teeth working for the private owner developer for the big family home or a holiday home. So that's where I think a huge number of architectural firms have had their focus, because that's where the money is. But gradually there are philanthropists, a lot of them are churches.
Right.
And there's now an organisation called Faith Housing Australia, which is looking at taking churches which are redundant and transforming them into housing, as they talk about moving from worship to mission. So they're saying it's not good enough just to go to church on Sunday and pray. You go, you spend 7 days a week trying to look after your fellow families. So that's a big shift in how the Anglicare, Uniting Christ, Church of Christ, Catholics are all looking at that possibility. You're also looking at the way in which wealthy investors are going, well, I can develop an apartment building and I make some more money, but how about I build a building that my family will own, much as has happened after the First World War, when people bought or built small apartment buildings and they're still in the family, and it's the grandchildren who are basically living off the rentals that come from those.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a change now, and that's, I guess, what I'm saying in summary is that's where our practice now finds ourselves. We distinguished ourselves from people who are working for the very wealthy on very large, what I call glabber homes. And we're now trying to work out what that diversity of other typologies might be. There are very, very good architectural firms looking at the high rise and the tall towers. And there's Yeah. And you know, Nick Turner's firm, Turner, has just published a book which documents how extraordinarily excellent the work he's done in those towers has been. But I'm interested in let a thousand flowers bloom against this inequality in the cities by lots of very small firms building low-rise types. The typologies that we're working on are boarding houses, co-living, duplexes, terraces, walk-up apartments. Can you manoeuvre those into areas where councils will be forced by the state government to let you have that kind of density in the area? So that's my hope. I mean, that's been a very dispiriting talk in one sense, in that Australia spent 100 years making sure that some people grow very wealthy from housing development and some people will fail and the poor will go homeless. I think architects are right at the very centre of righting that inequality.
Fascinating, Tony Wheeler. I've got to say, from history to economics to design to equality to peculiarities of the Reformation and Maoist slogans, we've heard it all. Thank you very much, Tony. That was actually an interesting explanation as to why we are where we are. And I don't think it's the whole explanation, but it's a very good overview, I've got to say. You've been listening to Tone Wheeler and his discussion on why our cities and housing breed inequality. This has been Branko Miletic from Talking Architecture and Design. Until next time, goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Talking Architecture and Design, brought to you in association with the Architecture and Design Network. You can catch up with news, projects, interviews, and much more at architectureanddesign.com.au, where you can also subscribe to our newsletters and magazine.